she's not mine.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Yes, and another day begins. Another week goes by. I got to tell you, everything's a little different. You know, Florida's opening up. Been out to eat a couple times. RJ and I went out last night for dinner. We went out and had dinner last night and ran into Jeannie from Fishy Radio. And there's, you know, you go to some places and you feel like, you know, it's mummy quarantine zombie apocalypse. And you go to the next place and it's like, okay, it's life, you know. I got to tell you, it's definitely...
And we got to go in the big RV.
Yeah, we got to go in the big RV.
So, you know, it's a takeout special when you've got the RV.
Well, I call it my drinking truck.
Your drinking truck.
Well, we went to a birthday party for a friend of mine in Punta Gorda, I don't know, about a week ago or so. And, you know, you get there and they're handing out masks and doing all that. And people have a couple of cocktails, and then they're giving you hugs and handshakes, and, you know, it's like, you know, you got one extreme the other, but I got to tell you, how many hands do I shake a day? Got to be 30, 50, easy, right?
Yeah.
Plus a few hugs.
Yeah.
Whatever. You know, and I go out, and I, when I get, you know, after somebody shakes my hand or whatever, I... You know, sanitize my hands and all that before I touch my face. And, you know, try and be socially conscious. But black-tipped sharks and sharks, speaking of socially conscious, well, they're one of the critters. When you're catching a lot of little sharks, you know there's no big sharks around.
True.
Because... True. They're way smarter than most of us. They eat the young when, you know, you got so long to leave the house and then, you know, I'm sorry, you just get eaten.
No, so, that's true.
Gators are the same way, though, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, they definitely are.
Doesn't initially the female protect the eggs and the young?
Yes.
And then they get to a certain size. They grow them until they're edible.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, first few months they're protected by mom, and then after that they're on their own.
Yeah,
but sharks, as soon as they're born, they're on their own. Get out, you know.
Really, the moment they're born, it's
the moment
like,
they're born.
You better run, or yep. you look mighty tasty there, little one.
Yeah. Some of them even cannibalize each other inside the womb.
Really?
Yeah.
They eat each other while they're still in the mother?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so that brings up a question that I have had for a while here.
Uh-oh.
I've been meaning to ask
you had
guys,
a twin at one point?
Yeah, well, I hope.
And, wow.
and he was
nice.
He was quite tasty. And this has to do with, it's a mermaid question.
Mermaid question.
I'm kind of more into maid mers.
Well,
opposite end to be female.
Does the top half taste like beef and the bottom half taste like fish? I mean, can you do surf and turf with one carcass?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
without a
good.
Doubt.
I'm asking for a friend.
I'm sure, without a doubt.
Right.
Shark fishing.
Yeah.
Now, if I was going to go out there and, you know, we have sea serpents, why wouldn't we have mermaids? You know, why not?
Who said we don't?
Yeah.
Where'd that come from?
There's no proof. Okay. When you're out there, there's two different schools of thought on this. One is drifting, and the other's anchoring up. Now, I'm an anchor-up person because I'm going to use chum bags. And in my feeling, if you're going to drift, why would you use a chum bag? The ones I don't understand are the guys who drift with the chum bags because you're drifting away from your scent. Or do you think it follows you?
No, I think... Well, I guess it depends on the wind and the tide, to be honest.
The wind and tide are going the same way, I guess it would make sense.
Right.
In some aspect. You know, but I feel when I anchor up and I put the chum bags out, what I'm looking for, let's use Charlotte Harbor as the example because it's the easiest one. We're right here. I'm going to look at the tide. Now, if the tide's going out and the water's flowing out towards Boca Raton Pass, I'm going to stay a little further north in the harbor. you know, depending on rain and stuff like that. You know, I want to get on the edge of the salinity because you're definitely going to get more sharks. But right now with this drought we're having, it's the same salt water all the way up to the Navigator. You go 15 miles upriver, you still got salt water. And all the way out to Buck Green Pass, pretty much same water. Now, so I'm going to anchor up somewhere where I'm going to look. And what I'm going to do is look at the contours from a chart of Charlotte Harbor. And it's a lot easier for me to see it on a chart than it is on a GPS. Because with the GPS, it's hard to expand back. The screen is so small, you lose the detail. Where if you have a big, you know, full-size chart, you can kind of get a good overlook of the thing. Now, sharks are timid. So they're going to run the deepest parts of the harbor. And the other thing about the deeper part of the harbor is it's most often gravel bottom. It's where there's not a lot of silt or muck buildup on it. And so when bait, crabs, fish, dead stuff is laying on that gravel, it's very easy for the sharks to pick up. Whereas if it's laying in the mud, it's a lot harder to find it and get it out of the mud and stuff. So they're preferably going to eat over that gravel bottom better. And the gravel bottoms are usually the deep parts. It's where the sand hasn't built up. So you've got deeper sections there. And knowing sharks are pretty timid, they don't want to be exposed. They're going to run those deeper corridors. And if you look on a chart of Charlotte Harbor, you're going to see from basically down by marker 6, there's a trough that runs all the way up through to, almost a marker 2 at the top of the harbor, up north of Punta Gorda. Now, I'm going to figure out somewhere along there. Now, I like going down a little bit further south in the harbor. I'm going to drop down kind of by the Pirate Harbor hole, and I'm going to anchor the boat up, and first thing I'm going to do is put my chum bag out. Now, I'm lazy, so I don't want to have to put the chum in a bag and all that. I buy the stuff already in a bag. Now, people say, well, this doesn't work. I'm like, yes, it does. You just have to be smarter than the bag the chum comes in. If you tie it off very short so it's sitting vertically, not laying on the water at all, what you want it to do is every time the boat rocks back and forth, you want it to dip the chum bag. So it has to be hanging, not laying flat on the water. If it's laying flat on the water, it doesn't want to come out of the bag. And you end up sitting, going back there, shaking the bag. But if you tie it very close so it's actually hanging with about half to two-thirds of the bag in the water and 25 to 30% of the bag out of the water, every time you get a boat goes by and you get the wake, it rocks the boat, dips the chum bag, shakes it, lets the chum come out real nice. What I like about a chum bag for doing this is that it's a slow, steady release of chum. The further away it is, the fainter the smell. The closer to the boat, the more potent the smell. So it's drawing the fish to the boat rather than, you know, if you take a ladle full of chum, like ground up fish and guts and stuff, and you throw it in the water, well, that's drifting with the tide. So it might attract fish, but it might attract fish a half a mile from you. There's no reason for the fish to come to the boat. But if you keep putting a little bit at a time, little bit at a time, little bit at a time, a little bit at a time for a long period of time, will bring you more sharks. Rather than a big glop of chum, like take a 5-gallon bucket, you dump it in the water. Well, you know, you experienced that when you were 16. You know, oop, okay, I'm done. All right, now what's going on? You know, nothing to show for it. So, you know, it's a couple different schools of thought on chumming for the sharks that way.
Okay.
But to me, one of the more important things is how you rig up. And what I'm looking at is I'm going to put at least 2 lines out, probably 3 or 4. My first line always has a bobber on it. It's my shortest lead from the bobber. I'm going down about 3-4 feet from the bobber. Cast it out away from the boat. Put in the rod holder, and before I close the bail, I'm going to pull line out the end of the rod for about 10 to 15 pulls. So that one's very far away from the boat. Now, the other thing that bobber's going to tell me is which way the tide is actually going, because it's being pulled by the tide. And you may think you're chumming southerly direction, and all of a sudden you find out, no, it's going almost on an eastward flow.
And the bobber's going to follow the chum slick, right? They're both going, they're both getting the same forces on them that make them go in a particular direction.
And that's exactly the point. Once you put that bobber line out, now you know which direction your chum's going to go. And if it's not going where you want to go, you know, you're not forced to be there. You know, you're not under a Democratic governor saying you have to be right there. You can actually go to a different spot and get your chum to flow in a better direction. And if you look at, and you've got in your head, you know where that trough is, and you put your anchor down, you put your bobber line out, and it's flowing off of that trough, away from it, what you want to do is get on the other side of that so the chum's going into that trough and following it down. So you might be a little too far east, and you might need to recorrect and go west, or you might be too far west and need to recorrect and go east, because the water doesn't flow symmetrically. Holes in the bottom, land masses coming out, you know, going in, sandbars, all have an effect on which way that water's flowing. Like if you put a hose up your driveway and you have cracks in the driveway or, you know, expansion joints, makes the water flow in a different pattern than if you just had a very smooth surface.
No, that's true.
So you never really know what way the water's going until you throw a bobber line out.
Right.
So then what I'm going to do is I got the bobber line out, it's flowing in the right place, I tie my chum bag down, get that started, and then my next line has one of two options. It's either going to be a free line bait or it's going to be very deep off the bobber. Let's say we're fishing in 16 feet of water, all right? We got 16 feet of water. If I free line a bait out and I have a modest current, say a mile or two an hour, you know, but water movement, but not ripping. I can throw that chump, that free line rod out, and I've got a line tied to my steel leader, my bait on it, and when I toss that out, I'm making a nice high arc cast, and I'm leaving the slack in the line when I set the rod in the rod holder, because I want there to be some slack there. I don't want to cast it out, then reel the line tight to the bait. The reason being is when the water goes through and grabs the line, that line has resistance on it. And picture a bed sheet blowing in the wind. You know, the wind picks it up, grabs it, it billows up in the middle, and then all of a sudden the bottom pops up. And that's what happens with that line when you're free lining it. You want the bait to... Initially, it hits the bottom, but then as the current grabs the line and starts pushing that line, it's going to lift that bait up just a bit and let it fall back down because it won't be able to maintain it. If the current's too strong, now it'll start maintaining that bait up in the water, eventually bringing it right to the surface. Well, now you pretty much got to put some sinkers on it. But I think the hardest one to figure out is what do you do when the tide's real slow, just barely moving? What I'm doing then is I'm in 16 feet of water. I'm going to go about 15 feet from my hook up to my float. Put that on the line, drop it over the side of the boat. Right?
Yeah.
Now, what I'm going to do with that is just hold the rod with the bail open and pull line out until that bobber gets the position I want it. I've got the one on the short line that I've casted out already. That's 3 or 4 feet from the surface. This bobber is keep it just within about a foot of the bottom where you're very, very likely to get a hit.
That makes sense.
It's kind of like free lining and no current. So it keeps it from laying dead on the bottom, you know.
But you also sometimes out there, because like you were saying, you know, you got some of those holes out there with some of those gravel bottoms. Well, those gravel bottoms are gravelly for a reason because there is some current. And sometimes the surface or the first couple feet will have no movement, but there still might be just a little bit of undercurrent there. And sometimes it can go the opposite way, where you have a little bit of current up on the surface and totally stone dead on the bottom. So usually you're still going to end up with a little bit of movement to help kind of keep it fluctuating there and not so just a dead stick on the bottom, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I found it really works pretty good. And then I'm going to take...
I found it works incredible because you taught me that. Okay. It's done great for me, so I'm following you to a T on it.
But the next line is going to have a sinker on it. And I'm going to use an oversized sinker. Any sinker I put on there is going to take it to the bottom. But what I want it to do is I'm going to cast it at a 45-degree angle off the back of the boat. The bait is going to be at least the size of my fist or bigger. I'm looking for a big fish with this. I got two lines out with 4-aught to 6-aught hooks. I'm using like 45-pound test leader, you know, nothing really big. I'm looking for 2 to 4 foot sharks because they're most likely to be swimming towards the surface, hence the one short end of the bobber, or they may be down by the bottom. So I got two lines out for them. And they got small baits on them, you know, about as a half a frozen sardine, a half a thread fin, something like that. If you've got too big a bait, you get a lot of runs, but you don't ever hook up the shark. You have to have, you figure that fish, the bait should be no more than an inch high, 2 inches long, you know what I mean, width, height, and length, 2 inches by 1 inch, you know, by an inch. Something small enough where that shark can actually grab it. He's going to smell it. They've got an amazing sense of smell. It doesn't have to be a big bait for them to find it. But now the one I put on the bottom, that's a bigger bait. I'm looking for 6-foot shark. I want something that's going to be big enough to entice that into bite, where they can grab it, pick up with it, and run with it. And you usually know when to start watching those rods. And the first two rods I've got out have a 2,500, 3,000, 4,000 spinning reel on them. 7-foot medium to medium heavy rods, nothing big because otherwise there's no fun in it. And then, but the next two rods, those are more the cobia style rods, maybe even a tarpon rod or a grouper rod, something that's going to be able to handle a bigger fish. And I sling that out with a bunch of lead on it to keep it out 45 degree angle off the boat. That's why it's usually easier with a bigger spinning rod. I can do it with a conventional, but I don't often have the room to cast a conventional properly. You know, like a 4-aught.
Yeah, I don't cast them often enough to be proficient at it.
The best way I've found to get a 4-aught out there is to put a big float on it. And when I've got a float that's up 14, 16 feet on the line, it's easy to deal with. As soon as it gets close to the boat, reach out, take the float off.
Yeah.
Don't reel it all and push it all the way down the thing. You ruin the bobber. Now, I know it's only 79 cents, but it's 79 cents. You know what I mean? Or 49 cents. And what's even worse is what if you don't have another one? And
right.
You just destroyed that one. So at that moment, it's not a 49 to 79 cent bobber. It's, I give you $20 for one right now.
No, that's true.
With those three type setups, that's a good way to catch sharks. And one of the reasons I'm bringing it up is the harbor's full of sharks.
Right.
And what I want to be able to do is catch small ones or big ones. Real light rods, real heavy rods. I want to be able to use them all.
Well, no, and that works. See, and I do both. I'll sometimes drift out there or anchor up. But a lot of times I'll actually drift for a little while, then I'll anchor up. Because I found that there's been days where you get out there and nothing looks like there's much life around. You know, you don't see any bait on the surface. You don't see any birds around. Haven't heard maybe any reports for a day or two. So what I found is going out there and setting up a drift for a little while.
Are you chumming while you drift?
Or? Yeah. Yeah, and usually, and the main reason why I do that is because I just feel that it's adding extra scent in the water because sometimes I've had where that's actually brought threadies up that were down deep. And start to show me that there's life in that area.
I was going to say, to me it sounds like it makes me feel better.
Well, it definitely makes me feel better because, I mean, chumming, you know, and I tell people this all the time, chumming will never, ever hurt you. Doesn't always help, but it will never, ever hurt. I've never seen an instance where you put out chum and, you know.
I actually have.
Yeah? I've seen where threadies have left the area.
Powder on the flats.
Yeah?
A day when it's real light wind. And you've got nice redfish on the flats. And if you put, like, some menhaden oil with some dry chum and, you know, like you'd use for white bait, you start tossing out, hoping to get a bunch of bait up towards the boat so the redfish will come.
Mm-hmm.
puts a slick on the water that the wind can't grab, turns right. it into a mirror. Yeah. Redfish look up, go, oh, boat, I'm going to run. Ah!
Yeah.
I mean, they leave the flat faster than if you were shooting at them.
Yeah.
And it literally, you can, there are circumstances where you leave the chum in the boat.
I can see that.
If it's shallow water or even a little bit deeper water, and you got a light ripple, then you start putting anything with oil out, any kind of, and chum always has oil in it.
Absolutely. It's all ground up fish.
And that turns the sheet top of the water into just a sheet of glass. It's just, you know, fish are looking up going, oh, I didn't know he was there. Look, boat, run.
I could see that.
So just but, letting you know, been there, done that one too.
But usually what I'll do is I'll put the chum bag out into an area like, say, the Pirate Harbor hole. Around that vicinity and start a drift for a little bit and have two baits usually out the back, one under a bobber and one either free lined or with a very, very small sinker just to kind of keep it suspended in the water column.
Depending upon how the drift and the current and everything's yeah. going. Now, here's the thing, Robert. Everybody wants to know. I'm out there and I'm shark fishing. What do I do about the tarpon? Because inevitably, if you're shark fishing, the tarpon are going to roll all around the boat. Now, if you're out there tarpon fishing, you're going to hook up shark after shark.
Absolutely.
But let's say, you know, tarpon is your deal. You are, you know, the tarpon king, the blind tarpon of Charlotte Harbor. So you're out there shark fishing. What should you have with you? Should you have it in the water? What should you be doing with it? How do you get, okay, here's the tarpon. What do I, oh, my God, I'm going to go rig everything up.
Usually I'm just going to have one extra spinning reel with a bait buster on it. I mean, just a swim bait, either a Storm Wild Eyes swim bait, 5 or 6 inch, or the DOA bait buster.
Now, you've got that pre-rigged on a rod. Usually mm-hmm. I would guess, I'm going to use an 8-foot rod so I can get some distance.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be an 8-foot rod spinning reel with a 50-pound braid and a 60-pound fluorocarbon leader. And with them starting to roll around, I'm going to cast to them if they're within casting distance. If they're just outside of casting distance and depending on which direction they're going, I may put a bobber on that and just open up, you know, cast it out as far as I can and then open the bail and let it drift out to them.
So if you've got a light chop,
mm-hmm.
putting a bobber on about 6 feet above a DOA bait buster
yep.
is literally a phenomenal way to fish.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Let's take a step back for a moment.
Okay.
You're out there. You see the tarpon. You got your DOA bait buster on. A, what's your favorite color in bait buster just overall? Because we know the colors change every week, every day, every hour.
Right.
But if you could only have one, which one would you have?
Oh, geez, it's a toss-up. But, no, it's going to be the green back pearl side.
I was going to say white and green or a root beer. Those would yeah. be the two you would kind of have to have.
Yeah, it's either going to be a white pearl side with a green back, pearl side with a black back, or root beer gold glitter. Those are pretty much the three. You can't go wrong with any of those three colors.
So you cast it out. Now, what do you do with the rod? Are you reeling fast, slow? Are you jigging the rod? Are you bouncing along? Are you just slow reeling? How do you work this lure? Number one question people ask is, how do I work the lure?
Generally speaking, I work it as miserably slow as I possibly can stand for the most part. I cast it out in the direction where I saw the fish rolling, and I try to cast just past them a little bit because generally you're in anywhere from 6 to 20 feet of water. I'll let it hit, and I keep my bail open, and I just count, and I'll let it sink. I'll let it sink down pretty much to the bottom, and then I'll start either a very slow to moderate retrieve while lifting my rod tip up slowly from, say, the rod being straight out in front of me to pointed down towards the water just a little bit. So let's say
4 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah. So at a 4 o'clock position, because my head would be at 12 o'clock. So at a 4 o'clock position, I'd have it pointed. And then I'm going to do a slow retrieve while lifting my rod up at the same time coming up.
Now, are you bouncing it while you lift the rod?
Not usually, because I know it's going to be kind of moving on its own. There's usually a little bit of ripple on the water.
Are you going from 4 o'clock up to 11 o'clock and then dropping it back down quickly? Or are you going from 4, 11, and then back to 4? Or what are you doing?
I try not to ever lift my rod above 10 o'clock.
Okay, but are you going to 10 o'clock?
Yeah. Yeah.
These are the things you're not being really clear. You're doing all the hand movements. You got the hand movements down pat. I can see what you're doing.
But we're not doing 4 o'clock. We're doing 7, you know, 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Because 4 o'clock is...
You could have just said 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock to 4 o'clock.
Okay.
That works. But...
He has a digital watch. Give him a break.
No, it's just a...
I just realized that was the problem. He's got a digital watch. So the bait is going basically up and down in a...
Slow arc pattern, right.
Yeah.
And I think however you can achieve that, you know, by moving your rod and whatever, that's what the tarpon are looking for.
Yeah, and you've usually got, you know, I'm constantly reeling the entire time.
So...
But slowly lifting the rod, but it also depends, like, if... If the fish are very happy staying in that area, you know, I'm trying to watch what the fish are doing, what's the wind doing, what is the boat doing as far as with the wind. Is it a real light ripple, or is there a little bit of chop, or is there boat traffic that's causing some wakes? Sometimes that screws me up a little bit with how my retrieve is, because if I get a hit during that boat wake coming by, that means I jostled the rod a little bit. And I got a hit, so that means on the next cast, I may change that pattern a little bit to reel in just a hair faster or jig just a little bit harder rather than just a slow arc. I might pop it and get it to maybe make a sudden movement.
Now, that was a pretty insightful statement. If, you know, the boat gets hit by a boat wake and the rod's being jerked a little bit and I do feel a bump or a hit, then I'm going to try and replicate that. That was pretty insightful. So anyway, if I'm doing it, cast out, see the splash. If I'm in 16 feet of water, I'm going to count 1,001, 1,002 until I get to 8,000. So 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, up to 8. And then I start reeling. And, you know, when the reel hits 12 o'clock, top, reel, 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 those would be when your hand would hit the 12 o'clock position on the reel, so you know how many, you know, that's your revolution of the reel about your count. You know, so it's just reel, 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 reel. It's about that speed of retrieve. And as you then pick your rod tip up and letting it fall, that will allow the bait to go up and down in the water. Now, if you're tarpon fishing... or shark fishing, rather. I'm sorry, you're shark fishing. How often do you hook up tarpon with a steel leader and a chunk of dead bait? What are your odds if you're out there and you've got your lines all out, you've got some big baits, some small baits, and you're just, you know, drifting along, big steel leaders, tarpon would never hit that, would they?
Usually at least one every shark trip. Usually at least one. There's been some days where it's been...
But wait a minute, don't
scary.
You have to have a perfect size bait and this beautiful
It's
got to
be exactly 3 fingers long.
It's got to be exactly 3 fingers. And if you don't do all that, you're never going to catch a tarpon.
Right, exactly.
Or you just throw a chunk of dead bait out on a steel leader and pretty much you hook up.
Yeah, yeah, and usually get them stuck where you actually land them.
That's the sad part, isn't it?
It's scary.
You're not tarpon fishing, so you got this big heavy rod, big steel leader, and you stand a really good chance of catching the tarpon.
Yeah.
But it goes along with the only time a tarpon is a mystical fish is when it's jumping out of the water on the end of your line. Before that, it's just a big old dumb fish looking for a meal. It's not mystical. It's not magical. It's just a big old fish, big mouth, and they're wanting something to eat.
Yeah.
And whether, you know, and how often they hit steel leader is staggering. And most people don't realize single-strand steel leader was the number one tarpon leader up until fluorocarbon came out. Then everybody switched over to the mono and fluorocarbon leaders. But prior to that, all the tarpon fishing was done with single-strand steel leaders.
Yeah. No, that's true.
That was the normal way to fish for tarpon.
Yeah.
Up until the 90s, when some of the older guys retired out, they still never went to the mono or fluorocarbon. They always used the single-strand steel leaders.
Yeah, they were running Dacron with a steel eater, and some of them were running mono with still a steel eater.
Yeah. So, you know, the whole idea behind this, when you're shark and tarpon fishing out there, it's good to be good at it. It's good to be instinctual at it. Better to be lucky, and best of all, be lucky and good.
True.
But luck plays a big part of it because, you know, it's always when you're not ready. It's always the smallest rod you have out.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something about it that's going to make you nuts. And if you're primed to know that, it's just the way it goes.
There is one other thing that I do also with either the drifting, but especially once I'm anchored, is that I'll do the same three rods like you're talking about, but I usually don't fish more than three rods, with the exception of there is 1/4 rod in the water, but it's literally only 2 feet under the water right out the back of the boat.
The cobia rod.
Yep. It's just sitting there with a mono leader on it because I've actually got an intended species targeted at that moment. So I'm not using steel. It's actually usually the tarpon rod. Once I anchor up at that point, I've got two tarpon rods. One that stays rigged up with the bait buster in case one shows up and swims by. But then the other one is just got a hook on it. So it's 60-pound fluorocarbon leader, a hook on it, and then I'm taking a frozen sardine, cut piece of mullet, ladyfish, whatever. Any kind of cut bait, it don't matter.
Or a live pinfish or crab or whatever you happen to have.
Yeah, I usually don't mess around with live bait.
So
I don't make myself crazy. I want to go fish.
You put the rod in the holder, but not in the back of the boat.
Nope.
This has to be in the middle of the boat somewhere. And you need a very light drag setting.
Yeah.
Because you have the potential of hooking up an 80-pound fish within 2 feet of the boat.
Yeah. That's where my bait runner comes in handy.
So the live liners, bait runners, those are the reels, the dual drags, that make this super easy. Mm-hmm. If you're using a regular spinning reel, it only has one drag on it just for fighting the fish. You got to back it way, way, way down. Get that very, very loose, because if you have any tension on that rod more than maybe a pound, it's going to break that rod. It's going to snap the rod, rip the holder off the boat, tear the screws out. I mean, there will be destruction.
Stuff's going to break.
Yeah, stuff's going to break.
Yeah, no matter what. You know, and it usually doesn't involve landing the fish. You know, so a lot of times when you're anchored up, and even sometimes when you're drifting, cobia just come right up to the boat and sit underneath it for a shade or an ambush point or for whatever reason. So I've got that rod doing the work for me. You know, I don't have to pay attention to it.
How am I going to get that cobia to social distance properly? They're hanging out right underneath the boat. They're only 3 or 4 feet away.
Yeah.
Cobia, COVID, they sound alike. You know, you know, I worry about stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, you're real concerned.
Yeah, we're glad you worry about stuff like that, Frank.
Well, you can tell.
I know. But no,
it scares me, so.
You know, but the thing is that people just don't realize how more often than not there's a cobia sitting under their boat. And a lot of times they actually notice it by complete accident while they either get bored screwing around and they say, okay, well, I'm going to hook up a little piece of shrimp on this pole and try to catch a little whatever while I'm anchored up here. I'll try to catch some bait that are showing up in my chum slick. But a lot of times they end up seeing one because they reach over the side to mess with their chum bag because they don't have it set up right. They go back there to shake it.
Right.
And then they look down and they see this nose sticking out from underneath the boat or a tail sticking out from underneath the boat wagging, and they just don't know what to do. But people are never prepared for it. You know, they don't have one rod.
Our listeners are. But if you're not one of our listeners, watch, and I'm going to say it anyway because I don't care about this being politically correct, Chinese fire drill.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, run around the boat. Oh, my God. By the time they stamp around and go hook sub up and do everything, they've already spooked the fish off.
Right.
You got to be ready.
Yeah.
You know, like the Boy Scouts, you know, you got to be prepared.
Absolutely.
Like you, this conversation we've had today is nothing at all about what we talked about in the truck.
Not at all.
So You know, poor Robert, he never knows where I'm going to go.
I'm just sitting here watching.
He makes all these, I have these lists in front of me and all these topics, and we're going to talk about this, that, the next thing, and I just go whack job out in the world somewhere.
He tells me to bring the baseball, but no, I got to bring the football, the soccer ball, the baseball, the volleyball. Let's just show up and see where this goes.
How far offshore out in the Gulf would you have to go right now to really be into a lot of fish? Into the Gulf of Mexico.
To get a good variety of stuff, because, I mean, I'm hearing a blackfin tuna, a few dolphin, still some kings out there, and AJ's opened on the 1st, I think it was. Realistically, about 25 to 30 miles.
Okay.
You know, that's where you're going to get your most variety, most consistency, and better sizes of everything.
And one of the reasons, you know, we use the mileage out is because we have a loop current in the Gulf of Mexico. And the water flows basically from Texas along the top of the Gulf, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, over to Florida, and then down our coast, north to south. But like all things in nature, it's not a perfect circle. And sometimes we get these, you know how they have the polar vortex that comes off of the Arctic and it drops these pocket of ice cold air down by us? Well, with that rotation in the Gulf, what did I call it? The
loop current.
Loop current. You get spinoffs from that of could be cooler water. Right now, in like 75 feet of water, the water is cooler than it is out in 100 feet of water. And it's much cooler than it is in 60 feet of water. It's little pockets of this cooler water that kind of come off the loop current, and they're just their own little spinning eddy.
Yeah.
And it just holds that cooler water there. And when you're out there, looking for changes in color of the water is a big thing. Looking for scum lines, weed lines, and especially ones that aren't moving the direction that the rest of the water is, because that could be a pocket, you know, a little mini eddy loop extra flow thing going on there.
Yeah, it's a little eddy. Basically, if you want to look at it, the easiest way to look at it is it's like a little tornado that spins off of the main part of the storm.
And it just forms its own little whirlpool-ish type thing, but it just spins off away from the rest of that water.
Right, but you're saying little. Well, some of these are literally 40, 50 miles long, 10 miles wide. You know, some of them are only a mile by a mile. They vary a lot.
Little is relevant when you're thinking the entire Gulf of Mexico.
True.
It could be a matter of, you know, a few hundred acres, or it could be, you know, the size of a small state.
Right.
But there are patches of this where the water's different. And that's one of the reasons we try to go over the water, how far out, because you're different water temperatures, different reef conditions, different water conditions.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Absolutely.
Number one time to go snook fishing on the beach right now. Oh, fish ID. People have an unusual sense of reality when it comes to fishing. We had a wonderful
fishing or fish IDing?
Well, both.
Okay.
This was mom, maybe an aunt, some younger kids, some guy in his 20s, super excited about all the fish they caught, and came in. We're telling one of the guys in the store, oh, I got this big redfish out there. The guy's like, you can't tell me that. I can't know that stuff. Redfish, you're not allowed to keep them. He walks out. It's a really nice black drum. Great eating size. I'm going to say about 20 pounds. But now I'm looking in the bucket. There's some sheephead in there, and I would say maybe a snapper or two. And very questionable in my mind as to are they legal size or not. And they didn't have any idea what the fish in there were. They were calling them all kinds of different names. But we don't work for the Marine Patrol, and you could very honestly, this was just a big mistake on their part. They were keeping this big redfish, which was actually a black drum. They weren't trying to hurt anybody. They weren't trying to poach fish. The sizes on some of them, I'm pretty sure, weren't quite making it. They were so happy. They were heading home to have this big fish fry. The family was all excited. I honestly didn't have the heart you know, once we found out it's not a redfish and all that, you know, and it's a big black trout, I really didn't even have the heart to bring up the rest of this stuff. They were so excited. And they're telling me all the recipes and all what they're going to do today. And I'm just thinking, you know, there's reasonable. And now if I see them again and they've got undersized fish or something, I'm going to call them out on it.
Right.
But I just thought, you know, today, let them have a party. It's been a pretty stressful time. They're just going to have this big family party, and they're so excited. So the question before the court is, did I do the right thing by keeping my mouth shut and just letting them, okay, they had a few fish I believe were undersized, and I'm pretty good at that. Should I have, you know, said, hey, guys, you know, you can't keep fish that small. You know, that's against the law. Or just let them kind of oblivious, then wait and see, you know, if it comes around the next time. Was I wrong to do it that way?
I don't know if it's a question of right or wrong. I mean, knowledge is power.
It's illegal.
Well,
I mean, they were absolutely doing something illegal. There's no doubt about it. But my question was, I think morally I did the right thing. They were so happy, and they just had no idea they broke any laws, and they were just so excited. I just didn't want to break the bubble.
I would have done it in a little different spin-off. I would have been like, no, it's not a redfish. Redfish are absolutely amazing, but what you've caught here is absolutely spectacular, too, and it's first cousin. I would educate them on that. But I would spin that off and say what you should do is, if you've got a smartphone, you can download the FWC app, which shows you the pictures of everyone.
I'm not sure this family actually had smartphones.
Well, the smartphone.
If they had a smartphone, I think it would have been the smarter of the two. They were just warm, wonderful people. But
I would have asked if they had a smartphone. If they didn't, and if we had a copy of the regulations, I would have said, here's a copy of the regulations that has photographs of all the fish
that's
in here, so you could
have,
identify it.
I should have said, wait a minute, let me go give you regulations so you know what you're doing.
Yeah, just so you can see a picture of the fish, and then that's a subtle way of saying, also you'll know that size limits of the fish,
And the odds are, too, if you don't tell them, they don't know, they're going to go back out and repeat it, and the odds are somewhere along the line they're going to get nailed. And so, you know, you help them out by saying exactly what Robert did. You know, here's the regulations, so in the future, you know what you can do and what you can't do.
That would have been the thing to do. Just go inside, grab a regulation book, and go, okay, you know, that wasn't a redfish, it was black drum. In case you have any other ideas, you know, this will tell you all the legal size limits, got pictures and, you know, numbers and paragraphs.
Right, and what you don't do is you don't shame them, you don't yell at them and you know, blah, blah,
The only ones that get shamed and yelled at are the guys that blatantly just know they're breaking
the law
are gloating about it. Those, and that only happens, what, once a year or something where you got some blatant jerk.
Yeah.
You know,
every
but
once in a while, you know, well, it's my canal and my dock and my fish. And
yeah,
it's
they're standing there with their grandson, you know, or
right,
something
yeah.
like that. It's like, really?
I look at him and go, you know, yeah, your grandson, you know, pretty awful kid. I wouldn't want to save anything for him either.
Yeah.
You know, I can understand why he hates his grandchild.
Right.
You know, I've met the kid, you know, so I get why he doesn't want to save anything for him.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I kind of like my grandkids, and I think they're pretty awesome, and they, you know, I should be saving fish for them.
Yeah.
Even though it does annoy me when I know some of the rules and regulations are just BS and stupid.
Right.
But even BS and stupid can save fish for my grandkids.
Yeah. 99% of the people out there just have very good intentions. It just slips.
So that's what you're saying about me. I had good intentions, I just didn't do it right.
Right.
I should have backed it up with a little friendly information without saying anything, but here's your rule book.
Yeah, here's a rule book that shows the actual photographs of the fish so you don't get them confused. And if you do get them confused, you could always take a picture of it and come in, show us the pictures, or give us a call while you're on the water, and
now
we'll try to walk you through it.
The rainy season's supposed to start on the second week of June.
And we're going to get rain this weekend, Friday, Saturday, from what I was looking on the TBO app.
Yeah, we've been looking.
80% chance, I think.
Yeah, we got a weird pressure system over us that's supposed to make it more summertime-ish for the next 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
But that's why.
Because we're heading into the rainier season. We do not have a rainy season in Florida. That's a myth that ended back in the 90s. So there is no rainy season, but we have a rainier season. Rainy season consists of isolated storms that are local generated storms. When it rains a little bit, it lands in tall grass, the trees, evaporates up and causes another storm right there on that because of that, not because there's a weather front coming through.
Right.
Weather fronts are not part of the rainy season, they're part of the rainier season. Rainy season rains were caused by localized rains because we are semi-arid desert climate. That's what South Florida is, semi-arid. And localized weather patterns are a big thing. Now, you can see a lot of that east of I-75 and west of I-95 in the middle of the state. We have a lot of farms, a lot of woods, a lot of swamps. As soon as it starts to rain, rain begets rain. You get all that rain, it gets in the high grass and then around the trees. Then the sun comes out, it cooks all that up, gets it steamy. That hot steam goes up into the air, forms a cloud. Next thing you know, it's raining again.
What about fire-making rain?
Fire-making rain?
Come on, you're the encyclopedia over there. Sometimes big firestorms can cause actual thunderstorms because of the moisture that's being burned off and with the thicker air can actually help build a thunderstorm in a different area where the smoke is going off to.
Yeah, it also has to do with the particulate that comes up from the smoke. It gets up into the upper atmosphere and it attracts water to it. And it creates thunderstorms. So we get that on the fire season here, too.
I think water is the one thing that makes me feel like humans are a tiny, you know, virus speck on the world. Because, you know, you're sitting out there with a garden hose trying to water your lawn. And think what it takes with a garden hose to put water in your lawn.
Right.
And then it rains over half the state. More than that in the same amount of time over to half of the state. Now, that's a lot of water.
It's kind of terrifying, really.
You know, we're talking, you know, I'm going to sit out there my garden hose, and I'm watering, and then, you know, it starts raining, and that amount of water goes over the entire freaking state.
Yeah.
That's water.
Yeah.
It
definitely makes you feel very insignificant.
Oh, yeah. Spanish jacks. Any bluefish still here?
I've heard of a couple, but very few. It's just been an oddball here and there. But the Spanish mackerel, and there's been a couple big schools of jacks down there from, like, the Pirate Harbor hole going out towards Boca Grande and the straits there. And they've been moving around a lot, but if you look for some birds or just a couple free-jumping Spanish mackerel. But there was one customer that actually ran into the jacks in a Spanish mackerel just because he saw the bottom was mudded up in a big kind of circular area and started casting into it. And it was all Spanish mackerel and all jacks.
Huh.
Never really saw any bait, nothing. I mean, his bottom machine lit up with a lot of different stuff, but he never saw anything jumping out of the water, no bait jump out of the water. And a
just
cage,
the mud in the water.
Just a muddy spot in the water, and he caught jacks up to like 8 pounds and a bunch of Spanish mackerel down there.
And muddying the water, spadefish are all the way up by Lashley Park.
They had one swim behind the house the other night.
Really?
Right at sunset, the girlfriend, Christina's like, here goes a spadefish, and then it came back around. And the spadefish behind the house, very rarely, they almost act like a jack.
Right.
They come through cooking. It's like they're bound and determined whether they're going up the canal or down the canal. They very seldom stick around, but when it came back, it went up underneath the mangroves and was kind of rooting around underneath there. But it surprised me that it was just one, because there's usually a couple. But.
Yeah, average size in the harbor is about 10 inches, can go down to, you know, just a couple inches. We don't see the big 20-inch ones like they do in the Atlantic. I wish we did. Really nice fish when they get up in that bigger sizes, you know.
They're a fun fight. It's been a long time since I've caught a spade fish on hook and line.
Yeah, my back's finally feeling better. Dr. Windsor, Access Chiropractic, he's open. He's right there, Murdoch, behind the car wash place. Looks like a little house, but he's awesome. So he got me walking a little better. I'm going back next week again, and hopefully... So I'll be able to start working on my boat, get that actually put back together, get the kayak boat done, and get out, get fishing again. So I'm looking forward to that. Freshwater's still going good. Hard to get bait, though. I think next week we're going to go deep into that.
Yeah.
Although I won't remember, so, you know, email me and remind me I'm supposed to talk about something.
Yeah, right. But he'll stick right on the subject, we promise.
Massive shortages of freshwater baits. Shortages of fishing tackle. Shortages of all kinds of stuff.
Is this the supply chain stuff we've been talking about?
Well, with the fishing, it's all the bait is raised and grown here in the United States, except night crawlers. We import a lot of those from Canada. But the demand was so high because every state who had, you know, a good governor was allowed to go fishing and hunting and go in the woods and go to the lakes. And so people who had never fished in their life, and we saw hundreds of them coming into the store. We had to hire extra people to teach all these people knots. But all across the America, people went fishing for the first time, many of them. And we've seen a lot of them again, but this has brought up massive shortages because they have to grow these shiners. They're farm-raised.
Well, the good thing is a lot of new people discovered fishing.
Oh, yeah.
Which a great benefit of this situation.
Millions of new people were introduced to fishing over this. But the bad news is none of the bait suppliers were ready for it. So while we are going to get some bait, we probably won't get what we want or as much as we want. Fish and Frank here, Robert in the chair across from me, RJ in command and control. And next week, does fishy start?
Next week. Get that out for us. Next week, right after our show.
Jeannie and Heather and the gang from Fishy Radio, the girls will be following us next week. So, more excitement. Stay tuned, fish fans. Same fish time, same fish channel. We'll be back. Sinker and line. I said fish.